Good to meet everybody. I remember many years ago I attended a wedding and all of the rabbis from yeshiva were sitting at one table. And then when the waiter came to ask who wants chicken, meat, whatever, so one of the rabbanim said he would prefer to have fish. He didn't want to risk it on eating the meat. So Rabbi Tendler was sitting at our table. And Rabbi Tendler has had a campaign for many years about the issue of the kashrus of the fish. So he told that rabbi, you know, Rabbi so-and-so, if you eat nevela, if you eat non-kosher meat, you only get once malchus. If you eat non-kosher fish, the Gemara says that sometimes you get six times malchus. It's a serious issue regarding the kashrus of fish. Now, the Chumash tells us how to determine whether any given fish is kosher or non-kosher. So it sounds very simple. If the fish has snapi ve'kaskesis, if it has fins and scales. The Mishnah tells us on Maseches Nida that there are sea animals, there are fish and other sea animals that have fins without scales, they're not kosher. But any animal that has scales certainly has fins. So you don't have to look to see if the fish has scales. If you see that it has fins, so automatically... You don't have to look to see if it has fins. If you see that it has scales, so automatically you know that it's kosher, that it has the fins and the scales. What if I'm buying a fish? So there are many fish that have scales, and we know that they're kosher. Sure. In the days of the Rishonim, there was a big dispute regarding the issue of fish. Some were of the opinion that only fish that look like fish are labeled as kosher if they have fins and scales. If it doesn't look like a fish, then it's not. What doesn't look like a fish? So the dispute was, what if you have a fish, let's say has a nose over here, a mouth and a nose, then it goes like this, it goes to the end, and the tail is straight. So some Rishonim insisted that the tail has to indent. If the tail doesn't indent, then you're not allowed to eat it. That was the big dispute that Tosfos quotes about the barbuta. It was a fish that had fins and scales, and the tail didn't go in like a V, it was a straight tail. And it was a whole tumult. And one of the Rishonim permitted the eating of the fish, and then he had a dream that he's going to burn in Gehenna because he fed everybody tray for fish, and he backed down from his position because of the dream, and there's a whole literature. Why don't we just ignore the dreams? We have a klal in the Gemara, the Derech Haloimus, La Mala, La Marina, so the whole literature on the dream and on the whole story. Halacha L'maaseh, we don't paskin like that dream. We eat soul. Soul is a kosher fish, and the tail is straight. The tail does not indent. So we paskin that any sea animal that has fins and scales is considered kosher. Yeah, but you have to see that it has the scales. If you don't see that it has scales, let's say I go to the fish store, and they already removed the scales. I just see a fish, and the proprietor of the store tells me that this is a tuna fish, whatever, this is a sole, and he removed the fins and the scales. So the din is that a non-Jew doesn't have nemanis to tell me that something is kosher. Even a Jew who doesn't keep kosher doesn't have nemanis to tell me that something is kosher. And the Mishnah gives the rule, achosher al adavar lo danu velo meido. One who violates that din itself is not to be considered trustworthy in that area. Let's say there's a woman who observes taras hamishpacha but does not observe kashrus. She doesn't keep kosher. So we cannot trust her when she tells us that the food is kosher. Or there's a woman who observes kashrus who doesn't observe taras hamishpacha. So you can't use that woman as the mikveh lady. If she personally doesn't observe taras hamishpacha, so she doesn't have nemanis in that area. So if you have a non-Jew is not obligated to observe the laws of kashrus. So a non-Jew doesn't have nemanis, just like a Jew who doesn't observe kashrus doesn't have nemanis in the area of kashrus. So you cannot buy a fish from a fish store if they've already removed the scales. If they remove the fins and the scales are still there. So the Mishnah tells us that any fish that has kol sheyesh lo kaskesis, yesh lo snapir. Any fish that has scales automatically has fins, so you don't have to worry about the fins. But if they remove the fins and the scales, so you cannot trust a non-Jew. But he's an expert and he tells me, he can tell by looking at the fish that it's kosher fish. Or I think I'm such an expert, I can tell by looking at the fish, I can identify it as fish X, Y, or Z. So the answer is that's impossible. The biggest expert in the world cannot identify a fish. Once you remove the fins and the scales, it's impossible for the biggest ichthyologist or whatever they call them, the fish experts. Something like that. It's impossible to identify. There are tens of thousands of fish all over the world, and it's impossible to identify a fish unless it has a simanim on it. You cannot identify. The one fish that Rav Moshe Feinstein was salmon. If you go to the store and they remove the fins and the scales because the salmon is pink, so you can tell by the color, and the nochri who's selling in the store tells you that this is salmon, shine. So you know that it's salmon because it's pink. And that was in the days of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. He passed away a long time ago. Now they discovered that the reason why salmon is pink is not because it's salmon, but it's rather because of the diet, because of the type of food that the salmon eats. And you can arrange to get any other kosher or non-kosher fish, you give it the same diet that the salmon will eat, and its flesh will also be pink. So that's a question today. Once in a while they do that, but most of the time they don't do that. So that's a question today. Can you still rely on what Rav Moshe Feinstein said, that if you go to the store and you want salmon, and the fellow in the fish store, and the nochri gives you something and it's pink, and he tells you that it's salmon, can you still rely on him? Because today it's possible that it's a different fish. They didn't dye it pink. They sometimes dye fish pink, but probably not in the fish stores. But rather the fish manufacturers, so to speak, those who have the lakes, they have artificial lakes, and they give special food to fish in order to have them pink flesh. So that's a question whether you can still rely on the nochri in the fish store when he tells you that this is salmon if it doesn't have the scale. But that's a Mishnah. The Mishnah says that you're not supposed to buy fish from a nochri unless it has the scales on the outside.
You're talking about the whole fish now. The whole fish.
Yeah.
What about the catfish with their knives?
That's another question. Even if I see that the fish has the scales, but if the shopkeeper is going to take the same knife that he cut a non-kosher fish with, he's going to cut the kosher fish. So even though nothing is hot, everything is cold. But if you have the schmaltz, you have the shamnunis from the non-kosher fish, and you're smearing it on the kosher fish, then you're going to have a problem. So if they would smear it on an apple, if you would have a knife that has chazer schmaltz on it, and I cut a cold apple with the knife, so it does make the apple tray. If you just have to wash off the whole surface, all of the schmaltz on the surface. If they took a knife that has non-kosher juices on it, either from meat or from non-kosher fish, and they cut a kosher fish with it, so the Shach writes in Yeriday, it doesn't help if you hold the fish under flowing water. You can wash all you want, and it's still going to have the schmaltzy tray for shamnunis on it. So he says you have to scrape off the surface. So if you buy fish in a store where they sell kosher and non-kosher fish, even if you see that this is a kosher fish, you see that the skin has scales on it, and you're going to watch the fellow cut up the fish, so you should insist that he should wash off the knife before he starts cutting up the kosher fish. That is the common practice. Even if you wouldn't ask him to, that is the common practice in the fish industry. They're always very careful to wash the knife between one fish and the other, because they don't want to mix the flavors together, but you still have to make sure that he washes the knife.
Doesn't washing help there? I mean, we have that on Sofa about the Zuru there, that Hepira Bula and the Sula Bula there with the knife there. Sofa about the Zuru, you remember that thing there?
The Gemara says that a lot of times it doesn't help to wash off a knife, because if the knife has a lot of cracks and crevices, yeah, so the schmaltz is going to get caught in the cracks. And then the Gemara talks about sticking in hard earth 10 times. Some people think that if you have a non-kosher knife and you plant it in the ground, you leave it for a week, it turns into kosher. That's not what it says in the Gemara. The Gemara says sometimes you have cracks and crevices in the knife, so you have to use steel wool. So they didn't have steel wool, so if they would stick it in hard earth 10 times, so that would be the equivalent of steel wool by us. But if you see that the knife is smooth, it's clean, it doesn't have any cracks and crevices, and a non-Jew washed it off, so then you have no problems.
But at Philly you can buy fish from a store that sells both kinds?
Yeah. If the shopkeeper shows you the fish before he cuts it up and you see that it has scales, so you know that it's a kosher fish. As long as it has scales, you know that it had fins. And then you have to be careful when he's going to cut off the skin, that he should wash off the knife, which they usually do anyway. He should wash off the knife well before he cuts your kosher fish.
What about the counter?
You have to make sure that he puts it on a piece of paper. Right? You shouldn't put it on the counter with the schmaltz from the non-kosher fish. That's correct, yeah.
So the idea that the din that we have, we need a mesora for certain, for other kinds, like for animals or for birds, or whatever. There was never an issue of a mesora with regard to fish.
Right, so that's what the Darkei Tshuva quotes from the Rosh's son. The Rosh had one son who wrote the Torah, then he had another son. So the son who didn't write the Torah wrote Tshuvas. So the Rosh Hashan writes in the Tshuvas that as far as fish are concerned, there are tens of thousands of fish. The halacha, there isn't even a minhag to require a masora, as long as you see that it has scales, so you know that it's kosher. So the question is, are all scales acceptable? Maybe some scales are not acceptable. So years ago, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was Rabbi Tendler who put up this whole issue about the swordfish. He said he doesn't accept the scales of the swordfish. And that became the big difference between the Orthodox and the conservative, that the conservative rabbinate used to accept swordfish as kosher, and the Orthodox didn't because of Rabbi Tendler. Truth of the matter is that the Achrayim say that swordfish is kosher. They say that the dag hacherif. So Rabbi Tanla said they're referring to something else. But I saw the swordfish, and many other people saw this. The swordfish has regular scales, like a normal fish, like anything else. So really, strictly speaking, the swordfish is probably kosher. Most Rabbanim don't accept Rabbi Tanla's position. The Poskim say explicitly that there's no specific shape that the scales have to have. The question is, sometimes you'll have a fish that the scales are so soft, they're not really protective. The whole idea, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, when they talk about the kosher and the non-kosher fish, the Gemara says that the scales are to protect the fish from the salt of the ocean. So sometimes you have scales that are so thin, it's just like another membrane of skin. So that's very questionable. That's a big issue in South Africa. They have some kind of a fish that Rab Chaim Moise's brother-in-law, Rabbi Kosofsky, Bishaito, 70 years ago, 80 years ago, he lived in South Africa, so he passed that fish is kosher. So every 20 years, there was someone who would tumble against the psak of the bezin, that the fish is not kosher. So in recent years, some fellow published a whole book to tumble against it. So I was just in South Africa last summer, so I was there for a week. So the morning I was about to leave, I had a daven in early minyan and I had a run. It was on a Monday morning, I think. So at the minyan, this fellow who put out the sefer came over to me and he asks me, where are you staying? I said, I'm leaving today. Where am I staying? I tell him. So he drove to the home where I was to give me a copy of a sefer, and then he left. He didn't even get it. He gave it to Balabas and he left. So I got it before I went to the airport. So Balabas, who drove me in the car, said, do you know that man? They say, yeah, I met him in America. He tells me they don't give him aliyas here. They don't respect him. They don't let him daven for an amid because he published the sefer against the bezin. He published the sefer assuring this fish. The argument that he had was not so bad, but the accepted psaka, his argument, one of his many arguments was that the scales were very soft and the scales were like a flesh consistency. It wasn't really like, the scales are usually like plastic. No scales on the fish, something like plastic. And this was not at all protective. So the Rabbanim Paskin, that's kosher. They said even such a scale is also acceptable, because that's what the Paskin writes in Shulchan Aruch.
Sturgeon and swordfish.
Right. So swordfish really has regular scales. Sturgeon was a machlekes in Europe in the days of the Nedarim Yehuda, because the scales are attached on both sides. So the Ramban in his commentary on Chumash writes that scales are only a siman tahara by fish if they're attached on one side and you can take a knife and scrape them all off like this. But if they're attached on both sides and you have to take a knife and put it on underneath the scale and pry it off, so the Ramban on Chumash writes that that's not acceptable. So the question is, there's no source in the Talmud for this. The Ramban came up with this original idea. So some of the later poskim say we shouldn't accept the Ramban, and others say we should accept the Ramban. So that was a legitimate dispute. As it happens, in Hungary they had, in different generations, this was a dispute regarding the sturgeon. So as it happens, the Orthodox rabbi who made the whole tumult that sturgeon is kosher, later on, years later, became a Reformed rabbi. So then the older Rabbanim said, you see, I told you all along, he was a good for nothing, and the sturgeon is treif. So I was involved with the whole issue with the reform. That was the beginning of the reform movement. But so the sturgeon is a bigger shayla than the swordfish. But the swordfish has
an evaluation, a reevaluation taking place with sturgeon and swordfish, maybe at the OU. I don't know where I heard it, but that they're reevaluating.
Haven't heard yet. I'm just there Friday. Haven't heard. Okay. I don't know.
So you're saying swordfish is kosher?
Swordfish. Most assume that swordfish is kosher. Rabbi Tendler years ago was the one who thought that it wasn't kosher because the scales are not the same as the scales on cod. But the halacha says they don't have to be the same as the scales on kada. The halacha says explicitly any shape or any consistency. The question is, if it's very soft, maybe that's a dispute in later commentaries. If the scales are very soft, they have the same consistency as skin. So is that also considered a scale or not? So that's a dispute.
Did you eat swordfish?
I would eat swordfish. Yeah. I saw the scales. I thought they were kosher. Yeah.
But sturgeon there, they have a sturgeon in Europe there, which was removable. I mean, it was not attached on both sides. That's
oh yeah?
That is there.
Okay.
In Europe,
something
they had kosher sturgeon
okay.
and not kosher sturgeon.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Regarding tuna fish, yeah.
I just wanted to clarify something you said before. Say you go to a regular store owned by a nothing, that you see fish in the counter that doesn't have any scales because, and you know what sole basically looks like.
The world's greatest expert on fish cannot identify a fish after he removed the scales.
You should say that a half shell. Somebody gave it a half shell. If it has a half shell. If somebody gives this store a half shell.
Means that someone went and checked all the fish. If you have a mashgiach who checks every fish and he sees that every fish has scale, okay. If there's someone on top of it, is good. That's okay.
What's the makar for the Ramban? He generally doesn't issue a psak without some basis.
He thinks in Parshanas HaMikra, he thinks that the word kaskeses means that it's only attached on one side. I don't know. That's why there was a big dispute later. The Magen Mishnah quotes the Ramban and he does accept it in his commentary on the side of the Rambam. And then you look in the Achrayim, so many Achrayim thought that we should not accept it.
So what's the general view nowadays?
I think it's usually some sturgeon is not permissible. Sturgeon is not permissible because of the Rambam, yeah. Tuna fish, there are three different kinds of tuna fish. There are many different kinds of tuna fish, but the only three that they sell for human consumption, they sell tuna fish for cat food and for dog food, different kinds of tuna. But the only three tuna that they sell for human consumption all have fins and scales. The albacore with the yellowfin and the skipjack, they all have fins and scales. And the other kinds of tuna fish, they don't sell at all. So Rashi, in his commentary on the Gemara, refers to tuna. The tuna is a kosher fish. And the Tosfos Rid on Maseches Avodah Zarah writes that if you have a non-Jewish company, and we know that all they deal in is tuna fish, so then you don't have to have anybody check to see whether you have fins or scales. We know that that's their business. They only deal in tuna fish. So he says this based on a passage in the Gemara. The Gemara says if you have Goyish fishermen who fish in a certain location. And we know that the only fish that they have there are this kind of fish. They never have any other kind of fish. So the Gemara says you can eat the fish from the Goyim even if they sell it to you after having removed the skin. So this statement from the Tosfos Rid is quoted both by Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Beis Yosef and by the Ramo in the Darkei Moshe. They both quote this Tosfos Rid. So that's why the Poskim in Europe already wrote. In Germany they had the tuna fish. So they quote the Tosfos Rid, they quote the Rashi, the tuna fish, the brands that we buy are all kosher. The only shaila is if it's cooked tuna fish, so you have to make sure that they didn't make the fish treif because they mixed in non-kosher oils and non-kosher ingredients. So that's what you have to have Ashgacha for. But the Ashgacha doesn't have to check to make sure that the fish are kosher.
What about dolphins? Dolphins that swim with the tuna.
The complaint was that when they catch the fish, sometimes they'll catch a dolphin in the net and they'll be killing it. It's a bitter achmanis, they're killing the dolphin and the species is going to be endangered. But they never put any dolphin in the cans. No one ever complained. No one ever said that they put dolphin in the cans.
I understand that Duggan puts the mashgiach in the can.
an issue regarding tuna fish, canned tuna fish, would be the issue of bishul akum. The rabbis prohibited us from eating kosher food if it was cooked, let's say, by next door neighbor, is a nice nochri, very nice fellow, and once in a while he cooks kosher food. So let's say he's making a barbecue or something, and he has a brand new grill. And he takes kosher food, and I watch all the ingredients. Everything is kosher, l'mahadrin, and l'mahadrin. And he cooks it, and he offers me some of the food. So the rabbis prohibited us from eating bishul akum, any food cooked by a non-Jew, because it may lead to intermarriage. I may enjoy the food so much, I may decide to, I or my children may decide to marry one of his children. The rabbis prohibited pasakum for the same reason. You're not permitted to eat bread that was baked by a non-Jew because it may lead to intermarriage. And they prohibited yeinakum, any wine that's manufactured by a non-Jew. You're not allowed to drink, even if you're going to drink it in your own home, not together with the non-Jew.
Is pasakum different? That it refers to a private and not a commercial establishment?
So then the Ashkenazim amekel, the Gemara had back and forth a debate. Ashkenazim have a tradition to be mekel if it's pas palter. Palter means a baker. If he bakes for the whole community, he's not my next door neighbor. If my next door neighbor makes an Italian bread and I watch the way he made it and everything is kosher ingredients and the dinners, you're not allowed to eat it. But if it's a company who's selling to the public, so why should I fall in love with his daughter? Everybody eats his bread. So Mistama, a nice non-Jew, will marry the daughter of the non-Jewish man. Why should one of my children intermarry with them? So the Rishonim, the Ashkenazim, developed this kula. If it's pas palter, it's a little bit in the Gemara. If it's pas palter, we would permit it because al alechem yichya ha'adam. The pasuk says lo al alechem levado yichya ha'adam. Man doesn't live on bread alone. You need ruchnias as well, but that's what the pasuk means. But the Rishonim paraphrase the pasuk. They say al alechem yichya ha'adam. Years ago, bread was a staple of one of the meals. That was the main thing in the meals. So since bread was so essential, so they developed this kula. That if the bread was baked by a palter, it was baked by a baker who distributes to the public. So there's less concern of intermarriage. So why should I marry his daughter? Mistama, a nice guy will marry his daughter. So that's why they were mater pas palter. Then that's the way it's accepted in Shulchan Aruch. By Ashkenazim, we're very mekel on that. The Sfardim are only mekel on pas palter if pas yisrael is not available. But if Pas Yisrael is available, then Shulchan Aruch says, Rabbi Yosef Kar writes, and the Sfardim follow that position, that you're not allowed to use this heter. And there are more rights that the Ashkenazim are mekel, even if Pas Yisrael is available, we're still mekel that you use Pas Palter. The Shach was an Ashkenazi. He lived in Vilna, in the Litvak. So the Shach writes that more correct is to follow the Mechavah.
I had the pita bread when I was young. I used to buy from the grain. Uh-huh. I had to go into packaging. As soon as Shomer Shabbos guy started packages.
So you stopped buying?
No.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right.
Shaka,
right.
There were some brands of tuna under the Ashkaf of the OU, and they printed a date in the Kateri.
Mm-hmm.
What was the reason for that? And is there a question of Chalavakum for those who will eat this tuna?
Yeah. Quite a few years ago, the companies put in a small amount of milk into the tuna fish to prevent the tuna fish from getting the flavor of the can. They didn't want it to taste like the metal of the kin. So those who don't eat the stam cholov, those who are machben cholov isol, should not eat that fish. Right? The shayla is, if by mistake you took this fish and you made a whole casserole, whatever, in a fleshig pot, would it make treif the pot? So the shayla was, you had close to shishim in the fish already. So if you put it in the casserole with other stuff, so by the time you baked it, you probably would already have shishim. It probably wouldn't make the pot treif. People called up, that was a big michshol at that time, because a lot of people didn't realize that they switched, they pulled out the rug under their feet, they switched, they made the tuna fish milchi. Everybody always thought that the tuna fish is parma. So at that time it was a big tumor. I think now they discontinued it already. You know? They don't have it anymore. Right? This heter that we follow, the Sfardim only follow the heter a pas palter, that you're allowed to eat bread that's baked by a baker that he sells to the public, only if Pas Yisrael is not available. The Ashkenazim, many Ashkenazim, most Ashkenazim are mekel, even if the Pas Yisrael is available, we allow Pas Palter, so that we follow the Tosfos and Beitza on the second parak, that this heter even applies to cakes or cookies, where the bracha is really mezonos, it's not hamotzi, but if you would eat enough of the cake or the cookies, it would become hamotzi, so that's considered also pas. It's called pas habobikisnin. It's a subcategory of pas that it's sometimes hamoitzi and you have to wash until it's a diamond bench bichas hamazen, and sometimes it's mezenis, you don't have to wash and you say ala michya. Let's say if you have Wheaties or Wheatina farina, you never say hamoitzi. You can eat a ton of it, you know, it's never going to become hamoitzi. That's a mezenis throughout. But you have other kinds of mezenis, cakes or cookies, which are a subcategory of pas. It's called pas habobikisnin. That sometimes is hamoitzi. So then Tosfos says, and that's the accepted opinion, that that's also called pas. And if it's baked by a non-Jew for the public, so that you have the heter of pas palter.
that's based on the assumption all the ingredients are kosher.
Yes.
Even with bread, they say yes, they smear the pans with lard or something like that. That's what the people say.
Years ago, they used to smear with lard. Now, our part of the America, they never smear with lard, but you have to make sure all the ingredients are kosher, of course. No, I'm just saying, if someone will give a hashgacha on cakes or cookies manufactured by non-Jews, he doesn't have to worry about the baking process. The baking process will have to be done by a Jew. The pas palter, the frashkenazim, we would be making. Even though pas yisrael is available. He would just have to check all the ingredients.
Contribute to the fire? Like no. Taking a match or a cigarette?
So that's what we say. He wouldn't have to.
Huh?
He wouldn't have to.
He would not have to.
Right, that's what we paskin. That since it's pas palter.
But if he throws it in, it's not pas akim anymore.
He solves the whole problem, yeah. That removes it.
Steering the coals on the neighbor's grill, is that considering not the Zach Carter?
Stir the coals, is okay. Chatoya Sa'esh removes the din of Pasakum. Removes the din of Pasakum. By Bishul Akum, it's a machlaikis. The Sfardim and the Ashkenazim. By Pasakum, the Gemara says, if the Jew stirs the coals, Chatoya Sa'geholim removes the prohibition of Pas. If my next door neighbor is making Italian bread, and I stir the coals before he does the baking, so that would make it pas yisrael. And by bishul akum, that's a machlokes. So the mechaber writes, and that's the position that the Sfardim follow, that chatoyas ha-gecholim doesn't help. The Jew has to put the food in. And the Ashkenazim ha-mekel on that also. That chatoyas gecholim is good enough to remove bishul akum as well.
What about one slice of pizza versus two slices? There was a question in the past, not now, but years ago.
It's still a question. Rav Moshe Feinstein at that time said that if you eat one piece of pizza, it's mezainis, but if you eat two pieces, he considered that a whole meal, and then you say hamotzi. And many others disagreed at that time. And today, many others disagree. They think even Rabbi Moshe Feinstein maybe would have changed his mind now because it's a different world. And a lot of people eat pizza as a meal. Years ago, people only ate pizza as a snack. And today, many people eat. The whole course, the whole meal is the pizza. I always said Hamoitzi on pizza. I always say Hamoitzi on pizza. It says in Shulchan Aruch that if you bake a pie, so you put in cherries in the pie, put apples in the pie, so that's called mezainis. That's called pas with a filling, with a kiss. A kiss is a pocket. Pas above a kisnin is bread that has a pocket. And what's in the pocket? Cherries or blackberries or apples or something like that. Rav Moshe Feinstein said if you have a lot of sugar, like most of the cakes that we have, so the whole thing is a big pocket full of sugar. So all of our cakes are mezainis, Rav Moshe said. All of our cakes are pas above a kisnin. So the Shulchan Aruch has the following shaila. What if I have dough on top, dough on the bottom, and I put the cheese in the middle, or I put the flesh in the middle? That's what's in the pocket. So Rabbi Yosef Kara writes in the Shulchan Aruch, that's not pasa bobekisnin. A filling makes it into a snack, apple pie, cherry pie or something. But if you put flesh in, and you have dough on top, dough on bottom, so well, you bake the sandwich. What's the difference whether you bake the bread separately and you cook the flesh separately, and then you made a sandwich by cutting the flesh, you put the flesh into two slices of bread? Well, you baked it melchatchila, the flesh or the cheese was in the bread, so you baked the sandwich. So the Mechaber writes, he calls that pasta. He says, if you bake the dough together with the cheese, so that's hamotzi. You bake the sandwich, so that's hamotzi. So I always understood that that's what pizza was.
You know that most of the egg challah that you have, but for zamis, they would use that for hamotzi.
That what?
Let's say a real egg challah. Examines, which is all eggs and sugar, tastes like so most people that's it's mezainis unless you're going to sit there and eat because especially any sweetened addition.
Yeah, if you have challah that has a lot of sugar in it, has raisins and sugar and eggs and a lot of stuff, then it's really mezainis. But if you kaveh suda out of it, then it becomes hamotzi. So there are different kinds of kriya suda. So sometimes the kriya suda is I sit and I eat a ton of the cake. I keep on eating cake and more cake and more cake. So that's a kriya suda. Then Magen Avraham claims, and that's Rav Moshe Feinstein accepts that, the Mishnah Berurah follows this also, that if you eat a little bit of cake in the middle of a whole meal, and the cake is to fill you also. If I, let's say I go to a wedding, I want to leave early, I can't stay till bench mezumah, so I don't wash. So I won't have to be obligated to bench mezumah. And then I eat so much, I'm ready to platz. I didn't have any bread. I eat so much, I'm ready to platz. And at the end of the meal, they serve cake. So the cake, I'm not eating the cake in order to, I'm not hungry by the time I eat the cake. So that's not called the kviya suda. But Moshe Feinstein writes, if I'm sitting at the wedding, I didn't wash. I don't want to wash because I plan to leave early. And then they serve the first course, and whatever, the second course, and I'm hungry. And the waiter didn't give the main course yet. So they have cookies on the table, so I start nibbling the cookies because I'm hungry. Not as a snack. I want to fill myself up, and I can't wait for the next course. So then you're eating the cookies in order to fill yourself up in conjunction with a whole meal that is going to fill you up. You're going to be ready to platz at the end of the meal. A wedding, a bar mitzvah, whatever. So then Rav Moshe says, based on the Mogan Avraham and the Mishnah Berurah, that that's called a kviya suda on the cake of the cookies. If you would have eaten the cake at the end of the meal, you had a whole meal, you didn't wash. At the end of the meal, you eat the cake, that's not to fill you up. That's not as a snack. But if you eat the cake before the meal, in the middle, with syrup, with the whole meal, so Rav Moshe paskins that that's called kviya suda.
Is there a mitzvah that describes the construction of Passover of the Kislev? Maybe we went through two sheets or three sheets so far.
There are different definitions in Shulchan Aruch. We're makel on all the definitions. The Shulchan Aruch says halacha kedibrei kulam lahakel. We're makel on all. So one pasah b'kisnin is if it has a filling, a kiss, literally a kiss is a packet. So it has cherries or apples, a pie that has a filling. Rav Moshe claims if you have sugar, so even though it's not a separate packet, he says the whole thing is in one big packet. The whole cake is full of sugar. So that's called pasah b'kisnin. Then you have another kind of pasah b'kisnin. If it's crackers, if it's a cracker type of a thing that's brittle and it falls apart, so that's also possible to kiss. But for such a type of a thing, it's obvious that it's eaten as a snack. So whatever the shape of it or the quality of the thing is such that it's eaten as a snack, then it's called pas habobikisnin. It's basically pas, but most of the time it'll be mezainis, and sometimes it'll become hamotzi, as opposed to Wheaties or Cheerios. That it's not a loaf shape. It's never going to become hamoitzi. You can eat five boxes, it's still going to be mezainis.
Rabbi Abadi always says that when he sees people eating mezainis rolls,
yeah,
eating three sandwiches, they can't sit for an hour eating. So
that's, right, that's really a mistake. They announce at a lot of the weddings that the women don't have to wash because all the rolls on the women's section are mezainis rolls. So that's really not right. They're eating cake. Okay, let's say it is mezainis rolls. So in order to be a mezainis roll, it has to have so much, May Paris has to have so much juice in it that when you eat it, it tastes like a cake. Usually the mezainis rolls taste come out the same as bread. Tastes the same as a chalas with a little egg mixed in. But even if it would taste like a mezainis, but if you're eating it in conjunction with a whole meal, so that's the definition of kviya suda. Let's say on the airline. So you give your mezainis roll, and they say beferish, this is a mezainis roll, and then they give you a whole meal together with the rest of the meal. So you're all full. So that's kriya suda. So you just that's
egg matzahs,
egg matzahs are mezainis.
It's apple juice, actually.
And it tastes like egg matzahs. You can tell it's a difference. And it falls apart. It's very soft, right? So egg matzahs are mezainis, unless you eat it in conjunction with a whole meal. So then it becomes converted to hamotzi. Regular matzah is a machloikas. The Sfardim recite mezainis on regular matzah, except for Pesach night.
It's called kishnis because right. By Yeshua there, the Talmud says later there, the Talmud says in Talmud Yonison says it's a called kishnis there.
Uh-huh. And Ashkenazim do not follow that. The Ashkenazim hold that the regular matzah is a hamotzi.
Because by the when Yeshua took the Yonim there. They put all bread in there, and the Talmud says there, Talmud Yonison says there, it's kishnis there.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Therefore, the Mitzvah in there.
Breadsticks that they have on the tables for chassidim, brittle breadsticks, if it's round.
Brittle breadsticks. I mean, it doesn't have the texture of bread. Not sure. I don't know. Shall we go through the deal?
Can you be kaveh suda while traveling?
Can one be kaveh suda by traveling?
Yeah, with the mezainis roll. Because they're passing the mezainis roll on the plane. It's talking you can't because you really can't be kaveh suda.
I don't know. When I eat on a plane, I feel full. Huh? When I eat the meal on a plane, even without the bread,
feel foolish.
I feel full.
What is the status of the breadsticks in general? Breadsticks. You have to make up like TM breadsticks?
Some of them are very thin. Those are very thin, I think for sure are mezainis. But some of them are fatter, but they're brittle. So it could be it's also mezainis, I'm not sure. But
if you're eating it within the context of
a whole meal,
then
I'm not sure.
That's like the cookie.
Could be. could be it's like the cookies. I'm not sure.
Can you leave a zimun then if you're filled up, like you were saying, you didn't watch, can you still get a zimun?
I mean, by mistake. I mean, a person said bar minim zaynus, and then he ate.
You're at the wedding. I mean, the cookies, you're doing what you said that you can do at a wedding.
And then he realizes afterwards, I made a mistake. I should have washed before. I should have said amoytzi.
Right.
And now he realizes he has to recite Birchas Hamazon. He can bench the, yeah, he can bench Mizum because he's just as obligated as everybody else to say the Birchas Hamazon. That is correct.
The Pasakim that you buy in the supermarket that has a Hefsher, an OU or okay, that's still Pasakim, just that the ingredients is kosher.
The ingredients are kosher. It's paspalter, so they allow it. It just says that on Shabbos and Yontif, it says in Shulchan Aruch, you're not allowed to eat paspalter. When I was growing up years ago in New York, everybody bought Stumas Chalas. Stumas was a non-Jewish company, but it had a hashgacha. So everybody bought Stumas Chalas for Shabbos and for Yontif. That's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. You're not supposed to do. You're not allowed to have paspalter. This heter is only kosher on the weekdays.
And
on Shabbos and Aseres and Meitshuva, you're not supposed to eat it. And on Shabbos and Yontif, you're not supposed to eat it. We treat Aseres and Meitshuva like a Yontif, like Shabbos and
Yontif.
Right, right. Right, so I said that the rabbis prohibited three things because we're concerned about the possibility of intermarriage. They prohibited, you're not allowed to drink wine manufactured by a non-Jew because I may enjoy the wine so much, I may decide to marry his child. You're not permitted to eat bread that was baked by a non-Jew because it may lead to intermarriage, and we have the heter because bread is so important for the meal, so al alechem yichi adam, so we allow the Ashkenazim more mekel, Sfaradim a little less mekel on the paspalter if it's baked by a baker who sells to the public. And then bishalakum, any food that was cooked by a non-Jew, so you're not allowed to eat. So that's one of the issues regarding the tuna fish. You don't buy tuna fish in a can raw, the tuna fish is cooked. So shouldn't there be an issue of bishalakum? Should there not be an issue of bishalakum? So the tuna fish is cooked in a very impersonal way. I don't know who in the world the fellow is. Even if I'm going to enjoy the tuna fish so much, I'm going to be chalashing to marry his daughter. It's going to take me a long time till anybody's going to figure out where the factory is in Pago Pago on the Pacific islands over there. So that's a question. Is there a prohibition of bishalakum if the thing is so far-fetched? It's palter. It's like a palter. He's selling to the whole world. He's making tuna fish, selling to the whole immediate world.
And it's processed on the boat. It's
huh?
Processed on the boat. It's made on the boat.
Okay. So the question is it... Do you still have the gzera derabbanan of bishalakum when the cooking is done in such a highly impersonal fashion? So the generally accepted opinion is that yes, that we're machmer on the bishalakum, even if this says in Shulchan Aruch, even if he's a restaurant owner and all the ingredients are kosher, but he's not Jewish and he's selling to the whole public and he has Jews and non-Jews buying there, so the bread that he bakes we would be allowed to eat, even though it's pas akum because he's a palter, but the food that he cooks, we would not be allowed to eat.
Do you trigger the switch in New York to cook in Pago Pago?
If a Jew would turn on the switch, that means that the Jew did the bishul, okay?
So
that would be
the
case. So that's the issue, okay? We're getting to it.
What about smoked fish, where there's no process of cooking per se, it just gets aged or processed to be smoked?
So here's the heter. Here, we're getting to the heter. So the Shulchan Aruch quotes The Talmud Yerushalmi, we usually study Talmud Bavli. So there is a Talmud Yerushalmi, is written before the Talmud Bavli. So the Talmud Yerushalmi is quoted in Shulchan Aruch, raises a question regarding Bishalakum. Does it only apply if you're cooked on a fire? Does it even apply if it's Me'ushan, if the thing is smoked? So because it's a Safek and the whole prohibition of Bishalakum is only Midirabbanon, so that's why it says in the Shulchan Aruch that Safek Derabbanon Lahakal, so we're Mekel. So that's by smoking. But smoking means that it's cold smoke. It's not burning hot smoke. The question is, that's not the way they process the tuna fish. The tuna fish is cooked by steaming. They shoot burning hot steam on the tuna fish, and it makes it fit for eating. After they cook the fish, basically, by the steam, then they put it into the packages, and then they put in the oils and the flavoring, and then they cook the cans in a big retort. They cook everything in a big retort, but the reason why they cook it a second time in a big retort is not to make it roi l'achila, not to make it edible. It's very tasty before. All the goyim, all the workers in the company in Puerto Rico, they always nibble on the tuna fish right after it was steamed. It's against the law. They're not supposed to nibble on it because the government says that it may not be healthy. There may be
bacteria,
right? So the reason why they cook it a second time, but the mice, everybody does eat it. The mashgiach also nibbles on it. After everybody says it's edible. It's a far-fetched chashash that it may have bacteria. So the reason why they cook it a second time when it's in the can is to kill all the germs. So Rav Avadya Yosef is of the opinion that there's no prohibition of bishalakum even if you cook with steam. Even though it doesn't say that in Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch says we're makel on smoking. Smoking means a cold smoke, not a burning hot smoke. And here the steam is burning hot, so maybe cooking with steam, cooking Ayyadei Kitor, is not the same as cooking Ayyadei Yishun. So maybe Ayyadei Kitor should be considered bishalakum. So Chacham Avadya is makel on that alone. So any kind of a fish that he is convinced, if they testify to him that it's processed by steaming, so he is makel on that. The others are not so 100% convinced that the cooking with steam doesn't pose a problem of bishalakum, but the tradition in the poskim from Europe from the last couple hundred years is whenever there's an issue of bishalakum, if you have two different tzadim lahokel, one tzad lahokel is really a machlokes, and the other tzad lahokel is really a machlokes. In each one we would have been machmer alone, but if you have both together, so then the minig is lahokel, we treat it like a svek. So here, the thing is processed in such an impersonal way, I'll never be able to find out who the person is who did the cooking. And he sells it to the whole world. The tuna fish cans are sold all over the world. So many are makel based on that alone. And even if you don't have our practices, we're not makel based on that alone. And even if you hold that, that's not sufficient heter, but if it's done by steaming, so then Chacham Avadya thinks that that's sufficient to be makel. So even those who don't follow that heter, but the tzirf of the both considerations, the common practice in Europe used to be that if the two tzadim lahokel, so you makel.
If you smoke cold smoke, let's say a shellfish together with a tuna fish,
mm-hmm.
and the smoke interchanges and you get a flavor of the non-kosher fish,
you got a problem.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Sure, that's Tom Kieker. You have the flavor from the non-kosher fish, and now let's eat the kosher food.
That's on the lax there. I mean, they smoke that in the same smoke oven there.
With non kosher.
Then you got a problem.
All tuna fish processed that way that you said with the steaming and then they cook it again. Are they all companies do it that way?
Every company has a different style. This is my brother in law does Hashgacha, Rabbi Gifter's son. So he does the Hashgacha for the OU tuna fish. So he said that's the way they always do it in Puerto Rico. Half a year he's in Puerto Rico and half a year he's in the Pacific.
So why, my question is, why do you need any kind of mashkiach? Or what are they doing? What are other plants doing that are different that you need?
Each plant has a different style. You have to have hashgacha to make sure that the oils are kosher, that what they put in the ingredients are kosher. Then you have to have, someone has to check out the system to make sure that the system is sufficient to rely on regarding the bishalakum process, the bishalakum problem.
Does that mean that if they would actually cook the fish, then it would not be permissible unless a Jew actually is involved with the cooking process?
Right.
So any fish that's processed through cooking and not through, let's say, smoking, would be
a problem of bishalakum.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The question is like this. A lot of times they take the tuna fish, the raw tuna fish. Let's say they don't steam it first. They take other companies. They take raw tuna fish, put it in a can with oils, and then they put the cans in a big room, this size of this room, a retort, and they cook it with steam. So the steam heats up the liquid inside the can. So the food is cooked in burning hot liquid. But the thing that made the liquid burning hot was steam. So would Rabbi Avadya Yosef be makel on that also? Is that considered bishal ayyadei kitor? No, the steam heated up the liquid and the liquid cooked the tuna fish. That's cooking ayyadei liquid. So that's a machlokes in early poskim.
We call that tzibah, we call that bishal. Because it's being cooked in oil.
Yeah.
It's not water.
Also. Yeah. No, the tuna fish is not fried. No, we know it's cooked. It's not fried.
Sardines are the same thing there.
sardines. Yeah, the tzaddikim in Europe, all the Chassidish rabbis, they all ate cooked sardines that were cooked by non-Jews. So the poskim quote that because there was a tziruf of two considerations, because it was impersonal, and it was done with steaming or some other tzad lahakam. Right, that was their classical approach. Also, that's another consideration, right? Different considerations. Okay, we'll get back to the wines later on. We'll talk a little bit more. So we discussed a little bit fish. Okay, you have to make sure that the fish that you buy has scales, and you can't rely on the merchant who tells you that this is a kosher fish. There's no way he can really identify. He doesn't have them on us. He doesn't have them on us after he removed the scales to say that this is a kosher fish.
It's slightly cut, but you see the skin on it still.
And
or
I see
cut a piece.
And I see that part of the skin has a scale on it. So then it's good.
So
okay.
That doesn't have to be a whole fish.
So no, let's say they have the scales on one piece.
You have to wash off the piece, or you take the piece that. Let's say he cut that piece with a.
That's how they package. A lot of times they package fish.
Fish store, there's a fish.
Yeah.
It's already been cut. You see the skin on the rest of the fish.
Yeah.
So can you buy that piece, the first slice that he's cut, or you have to ask him to slice the next piece for you? Because
no.
That first piece has been cut with a. Knife, you don't know if he washed the knife.
Okay, so then you have to buy a different piece of fish. Unless you know that he always washes the knife, which is usually the case. Usually in the fish industry, they're usually extremely careful to wash the knife all the time. Not for religious reasons, for their fish reasons. That's the way they run their business.
What about red-colored salmon?
Right.
Right,
that's what we mentioned before. We spoke about the pink color of the salmon.
Would you be able to rely on inspectors? I mean, because we say that for certain food, you can rely on government inspection. So if a fish store, presumably, I don't know what level of inspection they have, but if they have, the city comes in to inspect that what you claim you're selling, you aren't actually selling, would we be able to rely on that?
I don't think so. I don't think government would be makbid. If you're selling something similar to kosher fish, you say selling one type of fish and it's something very similar. So that's not the geneva. The din in the machus, so that's not geneva. If it's similar enough, it's okay.
Right, but if there would be an inspection in a situation, especially where it's marked or labeled, and city inspectors would come, would we say that it would be similar to other kinds of government inspection?
If we would be satisfied, if we would know that the government is extremely makpid, okay, so then we know that this is kind of a fish.
Like milk, milk is inspected.
Okay.
There's federal inspection for that.
Right.
But for fish, it's more likely to be local inspection.
Yeah.
But then it would be the same. We would be able to rely on
if the government would be very makpid, which I don't know is the case any country in the world. I never heard that the government is makpid. It has to be dafkid. It has to be something similar. As long as it's similar enough, so then the government would not care.
I think we rely on that when it comes to milk.
Yeah. The Moshe Feinstein says we rely. Yeah. Right. Yes.
So if I went into Fairway and I see the fish is all sitting there and this says salmon, I can take a piece?
Means salmon because of the pink color.
No, it has a half
salmon and there's skin on it, and he's got a big slab sitting there.
And it has skin on it, and I see that it has part of the skin has.
And if I go to food
and the skin has scales on it.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yes,
it does. Even the bite of the
skin. They probably cleaned most of it. If I couldn't help to pull out another one from the back, I don't know.
Well, if you have a big fish and part of it has the skin with the scales on it, so I see it's all part of the same fish. So if that part is kosher, this is kosher. Unless there's a okay, so.
And if I go to Food Emporium, it's already packaged with the skin on it. The scales are not there. I cannot buy it.
You cannot buy it if it doesn't have the scales, right? And the one exception to the rule is the salmon, and that's what we mentioned, that it's a little questionable whether that heter still applies. People are still relying on Rav Moshe, and that's the question whether it still applies. Okay, as far as eating birds are concerned, so the Chumash says you have to eat kosher birds as opposed to non-kosher birds. The Chumash never tells you, like fish, the Torah says it has to have fins and scales. The Chumash never tells you what the simonim are. The Chumash just gives you a list of all the non-kosher birds, and anything that's not on the list is automatically declared as kosher. So how do you know to identify which of these birds in the Chumash? Who's going to know what these birds? No one knows what they are. So the Mishnah in Chulin and the Gemara in Chulin, Perkei L'Treifis, gives you what the simonim are. So there are five simonim with all the chumras in the world. There are five, they're different opinions. Very famous sugya. Very famous, complicated sugya with a long bal hamor, the sugya of Nesher. In Hebrew literature, the Maskilish literature, they write about the days when they studied in the yeshiva and they broke their heads on the sugya of Nesher. Very complicated. So the Gemara gives you simonim, how to identify if a bird is kosher. So we follow the simonim. So the Gemara tells a story that on one occasion the rabbis, the Amoraim, determined that a certain bird that they had never seen before, a certain bird was kosher because it fits the bill, it follows all of the simonim, and they were eating it for a while, and then after a couple of months they realized they made a mistake, that they had misjudged, and it didn't have all the simonim that it required to determine that it's kosher. So they discontinued eating the bird. So Rashi writes a comment on that Gemara. In this Gemara, you see that it's a good idea that you should never eat birds based on the simanim, because you may make a mistake, like the rabbis of the Talmud made a mistake. So we can make a mistake as well. So this is quoted by the Ramo and Shulchan Aruch. Rabbi Yosef Kara does not quote this, because Rashi was from the Chachmei Ashkenaz. So, and the Sfardish Rabbanim never recommended such a chumra. So the Sfardim follow the simanim. If you have a bird that has all of the simanim, so then you identify that it's a kosher bird. And the Ramah quotes from the Sefer Issa V'Heta by Rabbeinu Yonah Ashkenazi. There were two Rabbeinu Yonahs. There was Rabbeinu Yonah Hasfardi, the famous Rabbeinu Yonah who wrote the Shari Tshuva. There's Rabbeinu Yonah Ashkenazi who wrote the Issa V'Heta that's quoted on every page, every other page, every page in Yeridah. They quote the Sefer Issa V'Heta Ha'oruch. So the Rabbeinu Yonah quotes in Issa V'Heta, the Minig is like Rashi, Ashkenazi and follow Rashi. We don't eat a bird unless we have a masora. We don't eat birds based on simonim unless we have a masora that the bird is kosher. So that's the issue regarding turkey. A turkey lives up to all the rules and regulations, has all the simonim of a kosher bird, but we never had a masora. The Jews in Europe never had turkey. So when Columbus discovered America and he brought back turkeys to Europe, so the Sephardim looked at the turkey, has all the simonim, so they started eating turkey. The Ashkenazim, 50 years later, said, hey, these are ultra-Orthodox Sephardim. They're eating the turkey. They must have had a Masora. So the Ashkenazim started eating the turkey also. Truth of the matter is, they never had a Masora on the turkey. So one of the Rabbanan writes, no, the lost 10 tribes lived in America. And they told the Heilige Columbus that it's a kosher bird. They had a Masora from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu. I don't know. Where did they make up such a Baba Maisa that the lost 10 tribes lived in America? They had a Masora. Chaloimus. What happened was that the Sephardim started eating because the Sephardim don't have such a minig that you have to have a masora on the bird, just like you don't need a masora on fish, you don't need a masora on birds. And Ashkenazim in the beginning didn't eat it, but then after 50 years went by or so, 75 years, so the Ashkenazim saw, look, the most religious Sephardim are eating it, so it must be kosher, so they started to eat it. And then later, years later, when Rabbanim started to tumul, Ashkenazi Rabbanim started to tumul, what's going on? We've never had a masora on the birds. So there was tumbling back and forth. So they quote that the Baal Shem Tov, the Chassidish of Baal Shem Tov, got upset. He says, the Mekatrig on Klal Yisrael, they're saying that the Jews are sinning. You're not allowed to say that turkey is not kosher. All the religious Jews are eating turkey, the turkey is kosher, and that's all. You should stop tumbling. So the Chassidish followed the Baal Shem Tov. Egezok that you're not allowed to tumble, you're not allowed to say the Jews are doing an aver. And others were not so convinced. So that's what they quote, the descendants of the Shaloh. The Shaloh lived in the 1500s. So they say the descendants of the Shaloh have a tradition for the Shaloh to avoid eating turkey. And here and there are people who avoid eating turkey because they claim there never was a masor on the turkey. And says in Shulchan Aruch, the Ashkenazim follow the meaning of Rashi, that you shouldn't eat a bird unless you have a masor.
Excuse me, but Rashi in his parish on Chumash identifies every one of the non-kosher birds.
Uh-huh.
Rashi gives a la'az for every one of the non-kosher birds.
Right?
Uh-huh. So does that not imply that when Rashi said that you can only eat birds which have masora, that he believed that he had such a masora?
I don't know. The Poskim say that the names of the birds keep on changing. Even if you have written in a sefer from the 1500s that a certain bird is kosher, now I have a bird that's known by that name, it could be that that's not the same bird that they're talking about, because in Loshem and Yodim they keep on switching names. So they say you can't rely on masoras that are written in Svarim. If you have an oral tradition that this is the bird that we always ate, this is the chicken that we always ate, so that's called a masora. But a masora in print, That's what all the latest farms say. They keep on changing the names of the birds.
Is there a species of duck that's not acceptable, that doesn't have
masorah? In Europe, there was big machlokes on different kinds of ducks, right? Because there was not a masorah on all of the ducks. Right. As far as kosher animals are concerned, so again, the Chumash does give simon. The Torah says you have to have malagera and mafris parson. It has to have split hoofs, and it has to chew its cud.
Just go back to the birds. Do we find among the Spartan that there's unanimity on those simonim, that there aren't any birds where some hold that all the simonim apply and others disagree with those?
The Spartan eat more birds than the Ashkenazim do.
Right, but I mean, there's no machlokas there whether the five simonim apply to all the species that they eat. Mm-hmm. In other words, you don't have any particular birds of which the Spartan themselves are.
Have a machlokas.
Whether the simonim apply. No, the simonim are clear cut enough.
Yeah, pretty clear.
There's no issue whether it applies to them or not.
I don't think so.
Is someone allowed to eat in a home that serves turkey if they don't eat turkey?
Mean I'm going to eat their turkey?
No, you're allowed to eat
other food.
Are you allowed to rely on the kosher? Are the
kalim
kosher?
Yeah, the kalim are kosher. It's a chumer not to eat turkey because you don't have a masara. Nah, doesn't make everything trick. I don't think so. I don't think you're muchiv to go that far. We'll talk about it later. The shayla was brought up when it comes to chalav. We may get to it tonight. We'll see. So regarding kashrus of animals, how do you determine whether any given animal is kosher? So the Torah says it has to be malagera. Umafris parser has to chew its cud and it has to have a split hoof. Sure? So that's easy enough. The Chumash lists off as one of the non-kosher animals, Shesua. What is Shesua? So the Gemara says Shesua has malagera and mafris parsa, and it's still not kosher. Why? Because the Shesua, Shoseya Shesa Shtei Prasa, so Shesua means that it has a split back. It has two shedras. It has two different backbones. So the Gemara has a dispute between Rabbi Shmuel. Can such an animal really exist? An animal can exist with two different backbones, two different spines that go from the head to the tail. So one opinion in Gemara, the animal doesn't exist. It can't live. It can't have such a min like that. So what in the world is the Pasuk talking about? The din is that you're permitted to eat a bent pekuah. If you slaughter a cow that's pregnant and it has inside the womb, a calf, so the shechit on the mother is acceptable on the calf, even if the calf is not a kosher animal. But if the calf inside, even if there's an abnormal development and it's not a kosher, it doesn't look like a kosher animal inside, so the din is that the shechit of the mother is good on the uber. But if the uber inside is a shesua, so then the shechit of the mother doesn't help on the shesua. So we were studying this in Yeridaya. So Rabbi Soloveitchik commented, and don't laugh, that the Shulchan Aruch is talking about such a far-fetched thing. He said that he used to give a hashgach on the slaughterhouse in Boston in earlier years, and he wasn't there every single day. He came for a short period of time to check to make sure that everything is being done properly. He saw more than once a shesua ben pekua. I was speaking about this in yeshiva a couple of years ago. So we had the previous dean, I forgot his name. The last dean who just retired, huh?
Adler Roosevelt?
No, after him. I forgot his name. So
Adler,
this
Adler.
Dean Adler. Adler. Yeah, Dean Adler. So he said, yes. He said he printed a book that has a shesu on the cover. He said ben pekua shesu is a very common thing. And he said, because it's an abnormal growth, and he printed a book that has it on the cover. He told me what the name is in English, what the name for the animal is in English. So one opinion in the Gemara is that such a type of an animal cannot possibly exist. And when it says in the Chumash that you're not allowed to eat it, it can only possibly be referring to a ben pekua shesu. The other opinion in Gemara is no, a ben pekua shesu would be mutter, but the pasuk must be talking about that type of an animal. There's such an animal somewhere in the jungles in the world, and that's the animal you're not allowed to eat. But if it would have been a ben pekua, then you would be mutter to eat it. So in Shulchan Aruch, they don't know how to paskin. So they go to Chumra, they say, we're concerned, maybe no such animal exists. And therefore we have to assume that it's referring to the ben pekua shesu, so we don't permit it. So the Torah Tamima, in his commentary on Chumash, raises an issue. He says he read in a book on biology that such an animal does exist in the African jungles, and he raises the issue, maybe we should reverse the psak from what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. The only reason why the Shulchan Aruch paskin the Chumra and the Ben Pekua Shesua is because they're assuming that no such animal exists. But now that they write that such an animal exists in the jungles in Africa, so we should say that's the Shesua. But if you have the Ben Pekua Shesua, it should be Mutta. So he raises an issue. So that's interesting. This Torah Tmima was written, 90 years ago, 80 years ago, a long time ago. So just about 10 years ago, the biologists of the world had a conference, and they came to the realization that they made a mistake 150 years ago, that animal in the African jungles does not chew its cud. There ain't no such animal. It looks like it's a person is chewing chewing gum. That's not called malagera. Malagera means after the food goes to the stomach, then it comes back up, then the animal keeps on chewing, goes back down, then it comes back up, goes down, comes back up. So they made a mistake. That animal is always chewing. They thought it's malagera. So they admitted that they made a mistake 150 years ago, and they said it's not malagera. To the best of their knowledge, there is no such animal. That's malagera, mafis paris, and it has a split, and it has two spines. So that's an issue, an interesting issue, whether we should still be machmer on the ben pekua shesua because of the psak and the shulchan aruch. Maybe we should reverse the psak. Maybe there is such an animal. Okay, so that was a tumult for a while. In Eretz Yisrael, soon after Hakamas HaMedina, there was an issue regarding the Zibu. So then it gestorben. The whole issue was quiet for 40, 45 years. And then they just started tumbling again 5 years ago. The Zibu is an animal that it's used in India. It's in India and it's in South America. It's a little bit like a cow. It gives off milk. The milk is not as healthy as the milk from a cow. But the cows have to drink a lot of water all the time. And the zebu is used to living in such a hot climate, it doesn't have to drink so much. Like camels don't have to drink so much. They'll drink water and they can last a couple of days with the water. So the zebu doesn't have to drink so much because it's used to living in a hot climate. And it has humps on its back. It looks like a cow with humps on its back, looks like a camel. So it has malager mafis parsa, 100%. It's kashal amahadrim and amahadrim. So what's the issue? They wanted to introduce zebu in Eretz Yisrael because the climate is so hot, it's hard to raise cows there, and the zebu flesh tastes kimat the same as the cow flesh. So in the days of Rav Herzog, when he was the first chief rabbi at the time of Hakamas HaMedina, so they wanted to import the zebus because the climate is such that it would be easier. So the Chazon Ish at that time had a whole correspondence with Rav Herzog, the whole thing is published, and he said, for the Litvakis it's going to be treif. Why? Because the Litvakis follow the Chochmas Sodom like the Bible. The Chayyadim Chochmas Sodom, that's the Bible for them. And there's a Shach in Yeridea where the Shach talks about there are differences in halacha between a behema and a chaya. The chaylev, there's certain parts of chaylev that are forbidden. If you eat chaylev, you chayv kores, that's only chaylev from a behema. Chaylev from a chaya is kosher. Or let's say the mitzvah of kisui hadam, after you do a shechita, you have to cover the dam, is only chayv yof. If you shech the behema, there's no kisui hadam. Also, there's beno, you're not allowed to shech the osvez beno on the same day. That's only if it's a behemoth. If it's a chayah, there's no prohibition of osvez beno. If it's a bird, there's no prohibition of osvez beno. So it's important to determine whether any given animal is a behemoth or a chayah. Does it have the isa chaylev? Does it have an isa osvez beno? Does it have a mitzvah kisi adam? So there are rules and regulations in the Gemara. How do you determine whether it's a behemoth or a chayah? By the shape of the horns. It's not so easy for a layman, for people who never saw animals, for people who never lived on a farm, so for sure it's hard to tell. Even people who do live on a farm, it's not so easy to determine. So the Shach writes, we are machma, you have to have a tradition. If you don't have a masaira, then you're not mekel. You don't have a masaira, not mekel on what? What did he mean? So the simple pshat is, if you have an animal and you're not sure whether it's a behem or a chaya, so you have to treat it l'chumra. Maybe it's a behem or a chaya. So you shouldn't eat the chaylev, and you shouldn't do osav ezebeno, and you should do kisei adam b'li brocha. Maybe it's a behem, maybe a chaya. That's a simple reading of the Shach. So the Chochmas Sodom, who lived in Vilna, the Shach lived in Vilna, the Chochmas Sodom was a dayan in Vilna. First he was a businessman, then the business didn't go so well, so they made him a dayan. So he writes based on the Shach. The Shach said that the meaning is you don't eat any animal unless you have a masorah. That's not really the simple reading of the Shach, doesn't say that. So the Chochmas Sodom writes like that. So the Chazon Ish pleaded with Rav Herzog. He said, you're going to give a hashgacha on zebu, all the Litvakas won't be able to eat it because we all follow the Chochmas Sodom. Chochmas Sodom claims that that was the meaning in Vilna. He understood that that's what the Shach is saying, that you can't eat it. So Rav Herzog checked with the Jews from India. and the religious Jews did eat the zibu there. So he said, no, we have a masara. Then the Chazon Ish said, no, a masara means from Talmid HaChachamim, that's not from religious Balabatim. Do they have any Talmid HaChachamim in India who say that this was always their practice? So Rav Herzog investigated and said, no. They themselves say they never had any Talmid HaChachamim there. Whoever approved of the Zibu, it was just the Balabatim assumed on their own. So he gave in. Rav Herzog gave in to the Chazon Ish, and they did not allow Shechting Zibu. So that was 60 years ago. At the time, almost 60 years ago, right soon after Hakamas HaMedina, they wanted to introduce Zibu, so they didn't. Then about 4 or 5 years ago, as it turns out, they were shechting cows in South America and sending them to Eretz Yisrael. They were freezing them, sending them to Eretz Yisrael. So most of the cows were cows, and some of the cows were zebu. So the shechet wouldn't bother. He wouldn't make a difference. He was shecht all of them, shecht. And they were selling zebu meat in Eretz Yisrael. So they started a whole tumult. On Thursday, our Erev Shabbos, I think, everybody's shalom was cooked already, all the food was already. So they started a whole tumbling, starting telephoning everybody, not allowed to eat the flesh for Shabbos, everything is strafed. They turned out it's a taruvis, everybody has zibu mixed in and all the flesh, no one's allowed to eat anything. So they made a whole tumble about the zibu, that the Chazanisha gasset for Litvakas. And whoever learned in a Lithuanian yeshiva, even Sfardim who learned in a Lithuanian yeshiva, become Litvakas. They all convert. They all convert to become Litvakas. They speak Yiddish. The Sfardim who learned in a Lithuanian yeshiva, they start speaking Yiddish. It's a little humorous. What do they have to speak? What's wrong in Lashon HaKodesh? They speak Yiddish because they have to identify with all the Litvakas. So they started a whole tumult. So the tumult was going on for a couple of weeks until some of the Rabbonim pointed out, look here. If you're going to ask the flesh from the zibu, you're going to parcel everybody's tefillin in all the mezuzahs. Because in South America, where they shech the zibu, they use the hide from the zibu for parchment to make tefillin and mezuzah. And you're going to have to parcel everybody's tefillin and mezuzah. So we'll parcel. If it's wrong, it's wrong. You got to parcel. So they explained there's a mistake over here. When the Chazon Ish said you're not allowed to use the zibu because there's no masorah, that's before they started to breed together the zebu with the cows. You're not allowed to. You're not allowed to hybrid two different types of animals. But they had non-Jews who were doing this in South America. So they came to the realization, if you want to have the best of both worlds, you want to have cow zebu hyphenated that gives best milk and it doesn't need so much water. So you have to have, I forgot which way, you have to have 3/8 one and 5/8 the other. Either 3/8 cow, 5/8 zebu, or 3/8 zebu, 5/8 cow. I forgot already what the percentage is. You have to take the grandparents and the parents, and you have to have such a blend. Then you have the best of both worlds. So they were breeding these together. And the Gemara says a biological rule in Chorus in the first parak that a kosher and a non-kosher animal cannot breed together. If you do artificial dissemination, we're not sure. It could be that it would be able to be moiled if you take artificial dissemination. But they don't. This is not done artificially. This is done actually. They hybrid together cows with zebus. So in the days of the Chazon Ish, they never did this breeding yet. They were just discussing the possibility of eating zebu. So the Chazon Ish said, we have no masorah. But the post can say, whenever you have a masorah on one animal, and you see that it breeds with another animal, and they have vladas, so obviously the masorah on the cow carries over to the zebu. So by now it's already assumed that the zebu is covered. So after a month and a half of tumbling in Eretz Yisrael, there's a whole tumult. About 4 or 5 years ago, there was a whole tumult at that time. So the whole tumult quieted down. So we assume now that the zebu is a kosher animal because it can breed with the cow. And all the tefillin and mezuzah that are written on it are assumed to be acceptable. The question is whether that rule that the Gemara has in the first Perek Mechur is that a kosher and a non-kosher animal cannot breed together and give off lotus, is that only apply to animals, to behemoths and chais, or does it apply to birds also? Because if I'm not mistaken, I think the turkeys and the chickens can also breed together. So I think some claim rare cases that they can breed together. So I think some Rabbanim write that the debate about the turkey that was in the Fria de Gedera is when they didn't realize that they can breed together with chickens. But today that we have a masorah on chickens, that chickens are kosher, and the turkeys with the chickens can breed together, so obviously the masorah on the chickens indicates that the turkeys are kosher as well. There's no need to be machmer.
Huh? The eggs are different. What breeding together means?
No, they can.
But the egg, who's the egg?
They can be moiled. I don't know. They can have a vlad together. No, they can have a vlad together.
Lays a chicken turkey. Comes out of a turkey.
So the eggs you can also differentiate between a kosher and a kosher and a tour.
Yeah.
Turkey eggs are round.
Has all the simanim. Has all the simanim like a kosher egg.
Yeah.
The turkey has the simanim of a kosher bird. The only issue is we don't have a masaira.
Oh.
So the post can write in Europe, but if you have a masaira for a kosher animal, and this can breed with another animal that you don't have a masaira and it has vladis, so the masaira and the kosher animal carries over on this animal. So that's what the later generations, they say the same is true regarding the turkey. We've been eating chickens for many generations, before the days of Rashi. We've been eating chickens in the days of Rashi. So that we have a masoram from the days of Rashi.
When the Gemara says, we're not sure, so go out and see what the Yidden are doing. Does that mean it's the Talmid Chacham or just the general public?
I don't know.
With respect to the Jews in India?
I don't know.
What about Basar Kafu? I mean, if the Zebu is coming in, it's frozen.
Right.
It's not kosher first.
Right. So the. So one of the additional prohibitions is, even if you have a kosher of the behemoth, but you're not allowed to eat the blood. One is not permitted to eat blood. If you eat the blood from the heart, if you take pure blood, when you shech the animal, a ton of blood gushes out. So that's the real Issa Karis, if you eat that blood. Dam shahanashama yotzebo, the blood that gushes out when you shech the animal. The goyim in the slaughterhouses, the shchorim, always find that very healthy. It doesn't taste good, but they find it healthy. They think that, so they drink it. But the Torah prohibits, we're not allowed to drink it. So if you eat that blood, you chayv koris. If you take a piece of flesh, you buy in the store and you didn't salt it, and you squeeze out the blood and you drink that, that's an iser, min haTorah. But there's no koris on that. That's called dam ha'evorim. The dam in the capillaries. If they drink the blood in the arteries, if you drink the blood that comes out when the animal dies, that's the real mekoy, that's the moch ha'medikadam. So we have to salt the flesh in order to remove the dam ho'evarim, in order to get out all of the dam. What if a person cooks the flesh and they didn't bother to salt the flesh? So that's a question in the Gemara in Menachos, whether dam shebishlo, dam that was cooked, is that an isa deraisa and isa derabbanim? Because the Torah prohibits dam because he's supposed to be zorik the dam on the mizbeach. And dam shebishlo, blood that is cooked, let's say I shech the korban and have the blood in the container, and the Chacham decides he's going to cook it over a Bunsen burner and then it's going to be zorik the dam on the mizbeach. So that's possible. If the dam is mevushal, before you do this week on the mizbech, so it's possible.
That Bunsen burner is broiling. Take the dam out.
No, let's have a container of blood.
Blood itself.
A container of blood. So if I'm a vashal, if I cook the blood, so it's no good for zrika ala mizbech. So the Gemara raises a dispute, has a machloikas, where the dam shebishlo is still an isa deraisa. Or no, how can it be an isa deraisa? The dam is only forbidden because it's supposed to be used ala mizbech. So we, the Ashkenazim paskin, the dam shebishlo is only the rabbon. As far as the svardim concerned, it's unclear what the mechaber passes. So they have a whole pilpul. Every generation they revisit the issue whether dam shebishlo is the raisa the rabbon. Ashkenazim are mekel on that. We assume dam shebishlo is only the rabbon. So the din is you have to salt the flesh in order to remove all of the dam. So we have a chumrah from the gaonim that if you have flesh, bosses shoshal gimel yamin beloy malicha. If you have oiva flesh, in Yiddish it's called oiva flesh. If you have meat, that you shechted the behemah more than 72 hours ago, 3 full days, each day has 24 hours, 72 hours went by, and you didn't salt the flesh, so we assume that the dam is going to get so stuck in the flesh, it's not going to help to do malicha, then you have to broil it. The only way to get out the dam is by broiling it. There were times when I was a little boy, during the middle of the Second World War, that many of the delivery trucks for the meat industry were used for the war effort, and they were delivering the flesh more than 72 hours after the Shechita. So they said the people had to broil all the flesh. When I was a little baby, we were eating a lot of broiled flesh. Mm-hmm. You couldn't salt it. So that's the din. Where did they dig up this idea that if 72 hours go by, you won't be able to kasha the flesh later on? So it's based, the Shagazari writes in his Tshuvas HaChadoshes, that it's based on the Mishnah in Yevamos. It's if a person dies, and you want to identify, a man dies, you want to identify the dead body, that his wife should be permitted to remarry. So you identify, this is the, I know, I recognize the person, this is the one who died. So if he has identification in his pocket, or he's wearing rings, or whatever, that's one thing. But let's say just looking at the face. So it says in the Mishnah, if the person was dead for more than 3 days, then we assume that the whole body may change. which is a fact, the whole facial appearance may change, and you can't rely on the identification just by hakoras haponim. Unless, the Gemara says, unless he was soaking in the river for the 3 days. If he was soaking in the river, so then it's okay. So this chumr from the Goyim is based on that Mishnah, that if a person was dead, if the flesh was geshachtened more than 72 hours ago, so maybe everything changed. Maybe the dam became so stuck in, you won't be able to get it out with malicha. But if the flesh was soaking in water, so we're makel, it doesn't have to soak in water the whole time. If you soaked it in water for a while, before the 72 hours were up, then you have another 72 hours from that time. And then if you soaked it in water again for a while, then you have another 72 hours after that. So what they used to do 70 years ago, they used to have truckloads of meat that was geschachten in Iowa, whatever, and they used to sprinkle a little water. So sometimes they would hose it down, sometimes they would hose it down seriously, and everything the surface got wet. And other times they used to sprinkle a little water on it just off Yotze Tzitzis. So that was a faucet. That was a big tumult years ago. Rav Soloveitchik used to complain, why are they making a fuss out of the halacha? Let them just say, we don't want to follow the Goyim. That's all. What do they say? They're following the Goyim and they're sprinkling water. It's a fake. A lot of them were not really washing off with one. So then the post can say, what happens if the flesh is frozen? If the meat is in a deep freeze within the 72 hours? They say, when the meat is in a deep freeze, so then it doesn't change. That's called basa kafu. Kafu, kuf pei vav aleph, means frozen. If the meat is frozen, so then there's no problem. So then there was a question, maybe the meat is frozen is only if the meat was in water and the water turned into solid ice. What if the meat is in the freezer? It's not in water that was turned to solid ice. The meat is in the freezer. So Rab Chaim Eiser writes, he doesn't see a difference between if the meat is in water and the water froze, or the meat is in the freezer and it froze without the water. It's the same thing. Bosa kafu was in it. So that's the question, does it have to be a deep freeze or is enough freezing? So many are makel, freezing is enough, doesn't have to be such a deep freeze if it's frozen. So that's an Eretz Yisrael, they always rely on that. So many were unhappy about that. So that's why the machmirim in Eretz Yisrael would not eat the meat that was imported from South America. Chas v'shom, they're not choshed that there's anything wrong with the shochtim. The shochtim are religious people, but because it took more than 72 hours, way more than 72 hours, till they delivered the meat, by the time of the shechit, until they delivered the meat to Eretz Yisrael, and they had it frozen, so they didn't want to eat the basa kafu. So that was an ongoing tumult in Eretz Yisrael, whether you can rely on this kuf. Basa kafu. Basa halak is another thing. That's glat kosher. That's glat kosher. We'll get to that. We'll get to that. There's another prohibition. Dam is prohibited. You're not allowed to eat the blood, so you have to salt the meat. Then the Gemara says you cannot salt, the way we read the Gemara, you cannot take the liver and salt it and assume they're getting out all the blood and then cook the liver. We insist that you have to broil the liver. Without broiling it, our psak is that the dam will not come out, but we are machmen that you need melicha muetis. You don't need the full salting to the same degree that you would need on a regular piece of meat. You have to at least put a little bit of salt on top of the meat. So that was years ago when everybody used to salt the livers at home. So you did a melicha muetis. But in Shulchan Aruch it says, if you're going to salt the livers and leave it here for a few minutes and then you're going to put it on the fire, so then there's a concern the salting may cause the liver to absorb the dam. If you salt the liver that has all the dam in it, so the salting, if you salt it as it's on the fire, the second before you put it on the fire, that's what you're supposed to do. But if you salt it here and sitting for a few minutes, then you're going to wake up and put it on the fire, then it's a concern. The salt will be mavliya the dam into the liver. So the way they do it, then all of now people buy broiled liver in the store. It's already packaged. It's already packaged. So in all of these places, they do not with the chassidish hashgacha, they do not do the melicha muetis. Because everything is done by non-Jews there with the supervision of mashgichim. If they're going to do melicha muetis, they're afraid the risk is too great that the goyim may leave it for a few minutes and then they're going to put it on the fire and it may become treif before they're going to put it on the fire. So they've done away with the minig of melicha muetis. I think it's a little unfair. They write on the package kosher l'mahadrim and l'mahadrim glat kosher, but they don't write in violation of the minig of doing melicha muetis. They're fooling the public in a certain sense.
In Ashkenaz, they didn't salt the liver before the thing.
Oh yeah, they never did melicha muetis. I remember when I was in the rabbinate for a few years in Paramus. So the first shaila that I got, I came on a Friday. So the first shaila that I got was, a woman brought her liver and she forgot to do the melicha muetis. What's the din? So the din is it, but yeah, but it's kosher. It's only a mini. It's not nikar adin. They never did. Okay. So that's the din of, that's the halacha of dam.
Going back to the question about dam, when you mentioned that the dam for Evarim, but isn't, if the dam for Evarim was poured on the Mizbeah, that also wasn't acceptable, right? It had to be
was not used,
dam,
yeah.
Dam,
Shanashama Yotzebo.
So why would there be a difference between dam that was cooked and dam for Evarim? Neither one was acceptable.
It's a very strong kash. I don't know. It's a very strong kash. But that's how we pass. And the dam shebishla is only the rabban. It's a very good kash. Maybe we'll just cover the topic of gid anosha, and then we'll continue next week, whenever the next shiur is. I forgot already.
New month sells roasted livers. Doesn't that
appear then
the OU besides the
Nir Batir? I think the Nir Batir with the OU. I think whenever they sell broiled livers, it's without Malicha Mu'ed.
So the OU is also a sanctuary?
Yeah.
So it's not only the Chassidish that are being over and not writing the OU?
Yeah, I think it's not fair. I think it's not right. Okay.
I think you have some say in the OU.
Okay, I'll try. I'll try to bring it up. Okay. Gid Anoshe, we just read last week in Chumash. There's a certain part of the leg of the animal that you're not permitted to eat. So you have to have someone who knows how to remove the chelev. We'll have to get the chelev some other time. And someone who knows how to remove the gid anosha. So min ha-Torah, the Gemara says only the gid anosha itself is prohibited. And mid the Rabbanu, they even prohibit the shuman ha-gid, the fat that's on top of the gid. Because if you allow the fat, so people may make a mistake and they'll eat part of the gid anosha. So I'll just close with this. The Rambam in Hilchos Korban Pesach writes that when you bring a korban pesach in the Beis Hamikdash, you have to broil it. So the mitzvah is you have to broil it. Roshu al krov al kirbo. You have to broil the whole korban pesach intact. Then you slice it up later. You don't slice it up first and then broil it. You have to broil the whole thing together. So the Rambam writes, you have to remove the chutei chelev and the chutei dam because it's going to make treif the whole korban pesach. If you're going to broil it together with, so to, it's not going to be 100% intact. Certain veins and arteries have to be removed. Then certain chelev. You don't burn all the chelev on the mizbeach, but certain chelev in the rabbanon has to be removed. Also, you're not allowed to eat it. And then you broil the whole korban pesach, and after you broil it, then you have to be careful to remove the gid anosha with the shuman hagid, with the fat on top of the gid anosha. So the Ravid always has his comments on the side of the Rambam. Ravid is very sharp tongue. So he writes, if I would be there in the Beis HaMikdash, when this character would bring his korban pesach, I would throw it on the floor and tell him he's not allowed to eat it. He broiled the Korban Pesach with the Gid Anoshe. What kind of a Meshuggah? He may treif the whole Korban Pesach. That's what the Ravid says. You're not allowed to broil the Korban Pesach with the Gid Anoshe. You have to remove it before. So the Kesef Mishneh, Rabbi Yosef Kari, writes in his commentary on the side. He wants to defend the Rambam. So he says, look here. There's a Machlekes Hatanoim in Perek Gid Anoshe in Chulin, where the Yesh Begid Menos and Tam Ein Begid Menos and Tam. So we paskin that Gid Anoshe, if it's cooked, you're not supposed to cook Gid Anoshe together with kosher food, but if by mistake you did cook it, so it does not make treif the kosher food, it doesn't have enough flavor that it should accomplish Nisinas Tam. So the Gid Anoshe does not make treif. So since there's a mitzvah to broil the whole Korban Pesach in one piece, you're not supposed to remove the Gid Anoshe till afterwards. Why be mevatel a mitzvah if b'diavad it doesn't make treif? The Shuman Agid, which is awesome of the Rabbanon, so that's a machloikis in Tesis, whether the Shuman Agid is regular fat that does give Nesinas Tam. So maybe you should insist that's going to make treif the whole Korban Pesach. So that's two opinions in Tesis. So one opinion in Tesis is, since the Gid Anoshe does Naseh B'Tam, so you can't be machman more in the Shuman Agid than in the Gid Anoshe itself. That's not the accepted opinion. We pass from Halach and Shulchan Aruch, and the Kes Mishnah assumes the Rambam also agrees, Shuman Agid does Asa. So how can the Rambam broil the Korban Pesach with the Shuman Agid? It's going to be treif. So the Kes Mishnah writes a fantastic answer that all the later poskim discuss. He says the prohibition of Shuman Agid is not ben HaTorah, it's not even mid the Rabbanon. He says the Gemara expression is that Shuman Agid is muta ben HaTorah, v'Yisrael kidoshim nohagu bo isa. The holy Jewish people accepted a minig on themselves. So he says it's not even an isa de Rabbanon, it's only a minig not to eat Shuman Agid. So he says, what do you do when you have a conflict between a real din and a minik? You have a real, on the one hand, you have a real din, you're supposed to broil the whole Korban Pesach intact. Then you have a minik that your Shuman Agid makes treif. So he says, whenever the minik, you always have to observe minhagim, but whenever the minik comes in conflict with a real din, so you have to observe the real din. So he says, all year long the Jews have a minig not to eat Shuman Agid. Once a year on Pesach night, everybody eats the tam of Shuman Agid. Everybody violates the minig. You cut out, after you finish boiling the carbon Pesach, you cut out the Gid, you cut out as much Shuman Agid as there is. But the flavor of the Shuman Agid taket will infiltrate into the rest of the carbon Pesach. And Mahatnish Kembrera, that's what the Kes Mishnah writes. This is other poskim also talk about that. We often are faced with a conflict between a real din and a minig. Just in this afternoon by Mincha we read that they took Yosef out from the prison by Galach, and he shaved because he was sitting in prison. So he shaved in order to go to the king. So the Mefarshim asked Akasha, but according to tradition it was Rosh Hashanah. What, he's shaving on Rosh Hashanah? Yosef HaTzarik. So the Chassam Sofer says, of course. Kovod HaMelech is a din, a real din. That the Ovis Kodem Matan Torah used to volunteer to observe Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, that's Amidas Chassidus. So what do you mean? If you have a conflict between a real din of Kovod HaMalchus and Amidas Chassidus, of course you have to observe the real din. A lot of times in life we come up with conflicts between a real din and a Chumrah and Amidas Chassidus. So that's what the Kesem Mishnah says over here and many other places also. You have to, whenever there's a conflict, so the real din takes precedence. Okay, Belin Neder, we'll have to continue next time.
What's the minig? I think of the Teimanim, about the shalak, of the Teimanim. They boil the meat before they eat it. It's a Rambam.
Yeah, absolutely.